OGL HD3 Philadelphia.
From the Piazza Premium Automobile Studios, powering your drive with 10 brands and 20 locations.
Always live on the free Odyssey app.
Kathy Barnett.
On Talk Radio 1210 WPHD.
You can't stop me!
Welcome to yet another episode of the Kathy Barnett Show. Thank each and every one of you for tuning in. This is part two of a conversation I had last week with Rabbi Raphael Shor. I want you guys, here it is. Here's his book, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Jew? Go out and get it. I'm not going to recap everything we talked about in that first episode. You can go wherever podcasts are heard. Wherever you listen to your podcast, you can go out there and you can listen to it. But you want that. You want to listen to it, okay? Because I'm not going to rehash what we talked about. We're just going to pick it up and keep on moving. But this is important. And I was just talking to my producer when we were saying, what do we want to call this? I was like, let's call it Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Jew and Why It Matters to You as an Individual. And you were saying, I'm going to bring Rabbi, I want to keep calling you Bishop. So if I call you Bishop, Rabbi, just go with it. but Rabbi, we were talking a few moments ago about why it matters to us when people hate the Jews. I mean, I'm not a Jew, so why should I care?
Right. That's a great question. And the answer is that the Jew is the canary in the coal mine, which means, you know, they used to put canaries in the mines because when the air got poisonous, the canaries were more sensitive. They had these light bodies, and so they would die. They would flip over. So the miners would see, oh my gosh, the canary died. That's a warning to us. The air is bad. It's poisonous. This is an environment we need to get out of immediately. So when anti-Semitism comes, when the Jews are being persecuted in a society, we're the canary in the coal mine, because it doesn't mean whatever starts with the Jews is not going to end with the Jews. And the reason is because, as we saw in the Holocaust and as we've seen many times, that anti-Semitism indicates a breakdown of the morals of the society, of the social order. If a society can start to persecute and hate a group so strongly, and evil always somehow finds the Jews first, then evil continues. They get the Jews, but evil doesn't finish there. It's not over then. So Hitler comes to the Jews, but then, and 6 million Jews were killed, but 60 million people were killed through World War II as a result of not listening. And you think you can appease them, but you can't. No, they're out for evil. So same thing in America. If anti-Semitism is tolerated on college campuses, as it has been for the last year or so, then you got to worry about what's the moral fabric of those universities. And a lot of conservatives in America understand that very clearly, that there's something wrong with the way people are thinking and the moral values on campus. And basically, they're empowering these very bad ideologies. And so on the campuses, it's the pro-Hamas people. This is not a good indication of where society is going. So that's the idea also of the Israel test that you mentioned before, that the relationship of societies to the Jewish people is indicative of where they're at. And an open, tolerant society with liberal, classical liberal values of peace and love and brotherhood and human rights will open arms to the Jewish people, and it will be a society where the Jewish people are accepted. And we go through periods of history in every society where it's like that. But then when a society's values start to crumble, the Jews get it first, and then it gets bad for everybody. So the Jews are the canary in the coal mine, and therefore it's relevant to everybody when the Jews are being persecuted.
I am absolutely agree with you. And in so much that I don't believe we should have tolerance when we see certain forms of hatred. And I believe that this, what we experienced after October 7th on our college campuses and in our streets with people marching, people shutting down schools, threatening young people's lives who are trying to just get to their classes. People were being barricaded into buildings for fear of their life. Mm-hmm. There's zero tolerance for that. I'm not trying to sit and listen to you. You have mm-hmm. nothing to say that I want to hear. And when I saw what Hamas did to these young babies, to these people, families, sitting families in front of each other and just doing horrible things, immediately I see animals. I want nothing to do with that. And I do not believe it is our responsibility to run cover for it or to pretend that we're trying to understand. There's nothing to understand with certain forms of evil. We should just be very emphatic. If we've learned anything over these past 4 years, that is to stop tolerating the intolerable.
Yes. And I think that relates to what's going on in Gaza, for example. Where Trump, I understood Trump saw today, the celebrations on the Palestinian streets in Gaza when they're handing back the bodies of the babies that were taken as captives and then murdered by the Palestinians. They're celebrating. The Palestinians today are celebrating en masse in their streets because this for them was a victory. And it's so horrifying, the inversion of values, the hatred of life is so extreme that it's astonishing. And yet the world has given them a pass. Like, unfortunately, the world leaders are not like you, Kathy. So what happened? What's happened is that the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinian street, they were ready to elect another Hamas government, but it's been 20 years since they did an election because they know that Hamas is going to be elected again. In other words, the majority of Palestinians, according to polls, are still willing to democratically elect a genocidal, terrorist, hating organization in a higher percentage.
These are the people. Yes. These are the people. These are Palestinian people. This is not just Hamas or Hezbollah or some of, you know, the ones that we've been told it's okay to dislike those people. No, these are the Palestinian people. A survey came out. I've talked about it extensively. You can go look at any of my other shows. You guys go look at the Rolodex there. But and I give the exact poll that was done right before October 7th, where they asked a question, who would the Palestinian people vote for? And over 58% of the Palestinian people said if elections were held, they, the Palestinian people, would vote for the leader of Hamas, first name Ismail. The Palestinian Authority believe the people would vote for Hamas, that they have not had an election in almost 20 years, because they too believe that if elections were held, the Palestinian people, not just Hamas, but the Palestinian people would vote for Hamas as their leaders.
As they did the first time.
And the Palestinian Authority learned a valuable lesson as Hamas leaders went through beheading everybody. So they've learned the lesson to not allow the people to have an election. We're just dealing with different people. And I think that that's one of the problems with the American people, that we think, I was in the military for 10 years. I traveled around the world and I too would see it, that we would walk into other people's countries and we as Americans would think, oh, well, they want what we want. Oh, if they just knew what we knew, they would want what we want too. Obama tried that during I can't remember what the name of it was called right now, but it was sold to Americans that, oh, we're going to depose of the Egyptian government and allow Muslimhood brothers, something like that, to do that. They want what we want. They want democracy. No, People don't want what right. They don't all think the way we think.
Right. And we tend to project our values onto all of humanity, like you say, which is incorrect. For the Palestinians and for much of the Islamic world, economic success and just living a comfortable life is not their highest value. Their highest value has to do with Islamic success, their religion's prominence in the yes. world. And look, to be fair, I don't think any human being is born bad. But what happened was Israel made the naive mistake in 1993 of making a peace deal with the Palestinians. And that was a mistake because it gave control of the education and media system to the Palestinians. And once they had independence, as they were given in Gaza also 20 years ago, and they had their own independent state, what they did with it, with their newfound freedom, was develop a terror state, to develop a society that was completely indoctrinated from birth yeah. into hating American values, hating America, hating the Jews, hating freedom, and believing they just wanted to establish an Islamic theocracy, not only where they did in Gaza, but throughout the Middle East and throughout the world. And this was motivating them. So I feel bad. I feel bad for Palestinian children who are being brainwashed, even though they're trying to kill me, and they are trying to kill me. But I feel bad because they have been brainwashed, just like Nazi youth were. The mistake right. that we need to realize, we Americans, we the West, we need to know, just like after World War II, when America and the world, the Allies, forced the denazification of Germany, we forced them to re-educate their people over a long period of time. We monitored it so that they would be educated for Western values and liberal values to make sure they didn't go back to their violent ways. We need to do the same thing with the Palestinians. And unfortunately, the world gives them a pass. And Trump's...
And,
go ahead.
And unfortunately, I believe the Palestinian people are intentionally designed to be a pebble, a forever pebble in the shoe of Israel, a thorn in the side. You know, Jordan took none of the Palestinian people. Egypt took none. No one wants the Palestinian people. Even when I've talked to a lot of people from, I've talked to Palestinians. She was adorable. And she was very frank about what Hamas and the Palestinian authorities have done to her people, to Palestinian people. But she was also very frank about how Jordan treats Palestinians. They keep them separate from the rest of their society. So anyway, so much to get into. You are listening to Kathy Barnett on the Kathy Barnett Show, and I am speaking with my new best friend, my rabbi-ish, Rabbi Raphael Shore. We're discussing his book, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Jew? We will be right back on the other side. See you.
This is Talk Radio 1210, WPHT, on demand. On demand.
I've been grinding all day.
Everyone, welcome back to the Kathy Barnett Show. I am talking to my new best friend, Rabbi Raphael Shore. We're discussing his book, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Jew? You guys can see I have an index card. I have almost 100 index cards of notes of reading this book. I started off reading your book thinking I was going to read a book about why do people hate the Jews? And it quickly became a mirror for me to look at. And it was exposing my own deep hurts and desires. Most of you know my own story. You know that I am the byproduct of a rape. My mother was very young when I was conceived. I grew up in dire poverty. I have the blood of slaves coursing through my veins. And there's a lot of lack there. A lot of negative, a lot of lack. And yet I am so grateful to be alive. I am so grateful for what my family were able to provide me. Very grateful for the life that I've been able to create with my husband and our children. And yet there is a sense, that sense of lack of identity. It is there. One, because of slavery, my history was severed. And I don't know who I am, but there's this hunger within me of trying to figure out what is my identity? What does it mean to have an identity? The power of an identity so that I can make sure my own children is rooted in that identity. And then I'm reading your book, Rabbi, and again, I began to connect. This isn't just about the Jews. It is, but not just. It's something that is woven throughout humanity, this thirst to understand, why am I here? What was I created for? What is my purpose? What am I supposed to be doing with the time that I have on earth? I'm going to just pause right there before I get emotional. I'm going to throw it to you.
Very good. Well, yes, I wrote this book in order to try to assist people in finding their identity. Now, I do it through the Jewish story, because the Jewish story is a universal story. And it also is a story that is all about identity, because I guess I'll tell you quickly my story, which I do tell in the book. I grew up in London, Ontario, Canada, as a typical Jew, typical American Jew, which means Judaism and being Jewish meant very little. It was there. It was a cultural consciousness. But I grew up amongst non-Jews, and it was fine. I had a great upbringing, and it was a lovely life. But the Jewish part of me was not in any way actualized. Then in grade 12, all of a sudden, going to the typical Friday night party, they locked the door and said, no Jews allowed.
Mm.
And it was like, what? I thought we're like one of the guys or one of the team or one of the people. No Jews allowed. It was a shocking experience, and it showed us, oh, anti-Semitism is still alive, even though we're not doing anything different as people, as Jews. I wasn't expressing myself in any way. But it started a journey for myself and my twin brother to become more spiritually connected and more religious as Jews, coming to yeshiva, studying Judaism in a school in Israel for many years, and becoming a rabbi. But the process was one of finding ourselves. And so in the book, that's what I'm talking about, is that through anti-Semitism is not just a problem of another bigotry, or the Jews are getting beaten up or sometimes killed. It's also affected our identity. We don't know who we are. We've lost track. We, the Jewish people, for the most part, have lost track of who we are. And so I'm trying to help us regain ourselves and the treasure and privilege of being Jewish, while at the same time loving all of humanity, in no way thinking this is not about being better in any way or being superior in any way. But it's a matter of all peoples have a unique character trait, and we're part of a very special people with a very special heritage. And yet most of us, because of the effect on our psyche of anti-Semitism, have difficulty expressing it, don't know about it. Our education system broke down. And I'm writing a book to say, hey, Jewish people, this is who you are. You're a special people, and own it, embrace it, love it. And if that story can inspire others to embrace who they are as well and strengthen their identity and their own unique mission, then that's a wonderful thing.
You know, I've gone through the process because my own identity has been severed. You know, years ago, I started kind of like have you ever seen a quilt be made? It's like patches from pieces. Here, there, right? Pieces. And you begin to create this identity, right? So I love history. So I'm reading, I'm studying Black history. Like I said, I spent a lot of time studying the Jewish history of how you enter your experience with the world, watching all of this being trodden down, and yet you thrive, right? I want that aspect in my own life, kind of thing. And so I've done that kind of work. But how do you, I just want to toss it out there, how do you build an identity when it's severed?
Well, I think the first thing is education, to find out, you know, and find out your history, find out your background, find out your who you are. So if you've reconnected and you've done some genealogy work, so find out, where do these people come from, and what were their values? What was their life like? Reconnect to this is your family. This is your people. In my case, it's about learning. You know, I had to I actually came and studied for a few years to find out, this is who we are. And it all started to make sense. All the things that sometimes didn't make sense. This is where my drive comes from. This is why when I meet people who are Jewish, wherever they are in the world, I say hello, and we are almost immediately feel like family. Now I know why, because we are family. You know, you take those Indian Jews and the Ethiopian Jews, and they're black and they're brown and they're white, and they're from all over, and yet we all connect.
Makes so much sense to me, you know, especially as I look at the American culture right now, which is like night and day from what I grew up. I mean, I grew up in a time, again, I grew up very impoverished, but I had no idea how poor I was as a young child. I was loved, and life made sense. And I believe that no one ever called me a victim. No one ever said, Kathy, you're black, you're a woman, you're poor. Or hang it up. It's a wrap. I earnestly believe that if I kept my nose clean, followed some basic rules, got an education, I could build a life for myself. And that's exactly what my husband and I have done. And then you fast forward. But back then, my identity was my family and the community, a very close knit. I represented the community. If I was walking from the top of the hill, my grandmother knew exactly what I had gotten into by the time I got to the bottom, because everyone was invested into the children. Mm-hmm. Now, fast forward so many years later, and we're very transient. People throw their grandparents or their parents into a nursing home so they can go live their best version of their life. I've met a lot of people who don't talk to their children, or their children, because of how they vote, won't talk to them. We're very, the family, the unit, the community has been diluted in such a way that it's easy for me to understand why things like transgenderism can just come on the scene, and it feels like overnight it has gone throughout every system of our country. Or, you know, the things that were common sense when I was growing up is no longer common sense. And I think a lot of that is, and then I look at communities like the Hindu community, very close-knit people. I look at the Jewish community, very close-knit people and community. And when you have that kind of closeness and that kind of community, your children get to thrive, and people are healthy and wealthy and mentally and emotionally more balanced. There's less dysfunction is what I'm watching. What do you say?
Yeah, 100%. And this is the kind of beautiful society that we want to create. And as I said, like the pushback, the negative values, the crazy values that you just described, it explains that weird alliance between Hamas supporters on campus and progressives. Like, what do LGBTQ people have in common? They're protesting against Israel together with the Hamas supporters.
I have no idea what Hamas would do to them.
Right, but if the gay people would go into Gaza, they would be killed very quickly. And yet they're rallying together. What they have together is they're pushing back against Judeo-Christian values. And really what you're describing is that the way to have a successful life, forget about money, successful life with meaning and emotional intelligence and gratitude is by adhering to those values and having family values and loving your children and staying together as a family and having a spiritual aspect. When you do that as a family and you do that as a society, so you'll be much more successful in life. Forget about money. Forget about money. And as a byproduct, you also won't be anti-Semitic.
I know, right? And that's a good thing. Real quick, what is anti-Semitism? Like, what does that mean? Just Jew hatred?
It's a misnomer. It's a bad word. It's one of the things that, you know, in my book, I say, Who's Afraid of Being Bad Jew? Learning to Love the Lessons of Jew Hatred. Anti-Semitism was a word created by anti-Semites. It was created in the 1800s by a precursor to the Nazis, a German anti-Semite.
Yeah.
And he called it anti-Semite. It was a guy named Wilhelm Marr in 1879. And he came up with anti-Semitism as part of the racism science of the day, to say that they're against Semites. But it was to describe Jews, because Arabs are also Semites, and that it wasn't about hating them. So it just became a way of framing it. And it's very problematic from my point of view, because it obfuscates, what is anti-Semitism? What is this word even? It's Jew hatred. Let's just call it. It's hatred of Jews.
I know.
But we obfuscate. So one of the things that I talk about also, I think, in the book is the de-Judaization of Jew hatred.
Mm.
We this was coined by Dennis Prager. But the idea is that we paint the Holocaust as if Hitler tried to kill the Jews. That had nothing to do with the Jews. He just needed to blame somebody. It had nothing to do with the Jews. He was just an insane lunatic with no ideology. It had nothing to do with Jews. We paint anti-Semitism as nothing to do with the Jews. It's just we had too much money or not enough money, or capitalism, communist. And so we de-Judaize it. And in the word anti-Semitism itself, we've de-Judaized Jew hatred. And so it's heavy. The message of being Jewish is heavy, like you said before. It's like we're carrying a burden of responsibility in the world, and there's a lot of resistance to it, not only from the world in the form of anti-Semitism, but even within the Jewish people in the form of owning who we are and loving who we are.
Yeah, absolutely. Guys, you are listening to The Kathy Barnett Show. I am here with Rabbi Raphael Shore discussing his book, Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Jew? I will see you on the other side.
This is Talk Radio 1210, WPHT On Demand. On Demand.
They try to shut us down and it ain't gonna slide. Only thing I fear is God and he
only slide. Goodness, this is the end of my time with the rabbi, Rabbi Raphael Shore, the author of Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Jew. It is worth you going to Amazon, wherever you purchase your books, and getting this, downloading this, listening to this, reading this. I found it to be just very pivotal in my own walk through this life. Rabbi, bringing you in, I want to give the balance of this over to you. As a Christian, and I'm unashamed, even though I'm talking to a Jew, of the fact that I'm a Christian. And you know, in the New Testament, someone asks, one of the apostles asked Jesus, teach us how to pray. And Jesus says, this is how you pray. Our Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come on earth as it is in heaven. Pausing it right there. And as a good Christian, I understand that one of my main purpose is to bring the kingdom, allow the kingdom of God to come from heaven to earth. And he does that through me. Now, because of my A-type personality, I immediately pull out pen and paper and I begin to create a list of the things I need to do. And it's exhausting. And then I'm reading your book, and in it you say, I don't know if you say it, I say it, but this is what I took away from your book, is that my role of bringing, because I'm thinking about being, you know, the Jew, and it's not like you guys are doing anything. You're just being. You're a Jew, and it's a being. It's a way of, it's just your life. It's not something you practice on Saturday or Sunday for a Christian, and then the rest of the week you get to do what you want to do. This is just who you are. It's a being. It's not like you're doing it. You're just being it. And I'm walking away with, after I'm reading your book, okay, my purpose is to create such a spiritual place that's not filled with a lot of muck and mud and craziness, that God's presence can easily live in me and affect the material world. Okay, I'm throwing it over to you. What is my purpose? What is our purpose?
This is obviously the most important question that you can ask in life. What is our purpose here? What are we doing here? As you say, I address this extensively in my book, coming through the back door of anti-Semitism to say, what is the Jewish mission on earth? But what I make very clear is that the Jewish mission on earth is a very universal mission. So what we say, what the Torah says, is the nature of life and the purpose of life is for everybody. It's not unique in any way to the Jews. It's just that the Torah has given us a certain roadmap to go on to help us get there. And everybody can adhere and take on the wisdom and try to do it. But essentially, it goes like this. We talked earlier, Kathy, about the idea that humanity is a body and a soul together. That's fundamental number one. We are an incredible creation by God, where we take in this animal being, just like, and we have this part of us that's just like every other animal on the planet that needs to eat and drink and sleep and have sex and everything else. And then on top of it, grafted a spiritual being that's the breath of God, a soul. And so it's the purpose of life is to elevate the body, to elevate the spiritual world to the physical world, to make this physical world that we live in into a spiritual world, to make this physical body that our life is into a spiritual life. That does not mean to denigrate or deny the physical. No, no, no. That's why we say to elevate. So when we have Shabbat every seventh day, when the Jewish people have Shabbat every seventh day, and we're separating, we're leaving behind technology, we're leaving behind our phones and our internet, and we're saying goodbye to it all, and we're going to spend 24 plus hours focusing on connection to family and connection to God. What do? We eat. We celebrate. We drink.
And you eat a lot.
We eat a lot.
It's
and
good.
We drink a little, and we make lachaims, and we have some wine and some scotch, and we have a good time. So we're
yes,
not denying the body. We're not denying the body and the physical in any way, but we're elevating it. We're taking it and saying, let's turn this life into a spiritual life with the body. Let's bring the body with us. And that's not easy. That's the point. And like you said, we do it with, it's our being. Judaism gives us a practice that allows us to be working on it constantly. And that's the idea. That's why we have so many commandments, because, you know, pray every day. Because what, are you going to forget God one day? See, the idea is like this. The idea is that we're living in a physical world, but it's an illusion to think that that's the end.
Right.
You know that as a Christian. What we all believe in common, which is that we are in a spiritual world, and it has a physical world also. So are you going to be aware of that reality constantly or once a week for a few minutes? You see what I'm saying? So the ideal is that you create structure and ritual and practices in your life so that every second of every day of your life, you're elevated and you're connecting, and you're connecting to that higher part of yourself. So when you see another human being, you connect that they are also created in God's image and that they are a soul, and you can love them for being very special. And when you start to get angry or upset about something, then you realize, oh, I shouldn't let my instincts just take control.
I mean, it's very practical.
It is. It's very practical.
It's very practical. This is just, and again, and I know you have your 613 rules, but it feels very practical. And yes, there is discipline. And yes, there is work. And there is a denying of the self. And I like that. I like the fact that this is not the end. I believe this is not the end. I believe we take our last breath on this side and we step immediately into eternity. And I believe I'm going to be held accountable for the life and the decisions that I've made here on this side. And I want to live a life that has purpose and meaning and not just biding my time I'm gone. And you know, and I was talking to you a little bit off camera, is that, you know, even having a conversation about spirituality and that there's something other than this physical world of politics, economics, and I enjoy all of it. I'm all about understanding economics and politics and all of that. But that's not the end. That's not all there is. There is more than just, you know, what's going on in Washington, D.C. and around the world. But there's this other element of, is there more? And I do believe there is more. And I believe that that is the pursuit that we're supposed to be on, the journey we're supposed to be on.
Well, that's why I say, and, you know, I have a whole chapter on that becomes the choice, because, again, one of the things that the anti-Semitism, and especially in the case of Adolf Hitler, points out is that there really is only two ways of looking at the world. Either we're part of the animal kingdom and we're animals, in which case might makes right, natural selection is the correct morality to choose, or the correct morality is because we are created in the image of God and we actually have souls. We're not just bodies, but we're souls. That changes everything. And if you follow that line, then it's like you said, we're souls. Souls don't die. Souls are spiritual beings. The body dies like all other animals, but souls keep going. And that's a fundamental.
And to those who may be like, oh, like this is too heavy. This is too much spiritual. You know, because we're okay with talking about humanism. We're okay with talking about progressives, right? And progressives are just simply those who said, yeah, there was a time when we needed all of this spiritual mumbo jumbo, but we progress beyond that now. You know, we're smarter than our ancestors. We don't need all the Bible, the 613 rules. We got this. And all I say to them is, how have we been living these past 4 years?
How'd that work out for you?
How is humanism, right? Like, you can't talk about God, you can't talk about spirituality. How has that really worked out for us, where we have little girls having their breasts removed, little boys being chemically castrated, grown men going into showering with little girls? Humanism hasn't worked out for us. I think we saw a lot of that in November 5th last year, presidential election, of people waking up saying, wait a minute, we were lied to. Humanism isn't working out well for us. Well, if it's not humanism, which is the body, well, where are you going to pivot to? It's spiritual. It's something bigger than yourself, whatever you want to call it.
Right.
It's something that has to be bigger than this exact moment.
Right. And really, that's also a core of the optimism that I have. Because if you look at the last 4 years, or even sometimes in the last 100 or 200 years, you can see a descending part of humanity. But if you look at the big trajectory over 3,000 years that the Jewish people have been involved in this grand task of helping to humanity to come to a higher place, we can be very positive and very optimistic, because Judeo-Christian values have taken hold. This is what Hitler was freaking out about. And the Judeo-Christian world ideas have taken hold to a large degree in the world. The Jewish people have come back to the land of Israel. Prophecies have been fulfilled. In other words, the story was laid out. When God gave the Torah to the Jewish people 3,000 years ago, he said, here's the plot. Here's the plot, just like a good book. It's all in there. This is the, let me tell you how the next 3,000 years is going to go. And guess what? It's all happened for the good and the bad along the bumpy ride of humanity, and a very bumpy ride for the Jewish people. But overall, humanity is going step by step to a higher place and a higher plane. And it's up to each and every one of us, all humans, to do our part to become more spiritual beings, to adhere to the good values. And if we all do that as a society, we will come to a place where we're living in a very godly and beautiful world. And that's where we can be very optimistic, because we know we're almost there.
Going back to your Israel test, you said we all come to these two points about the Jewish people. We all have it. We all thinking about it. The Israel test is, what do you think about it? Do you arrive to those two?
How do you react? Right? How do you react?
Do you arrive at that point with appreciation or agitation? Today, you know, it's Kanye West. Tomorrow, it'll be someone new. Let me ask you this, because I feel like, as a Black person, I feel like I can ask you this and survive. Kind of like with being Black, everywhere, if I had closed my eyes a couple of years ago and just listened to the rhetoric, I would have thought I was back in slavery days. Because everyone was talking as if slavery was right upon me right now, right? Mm-hmm. Or Jim Crow laws was like yesterday, and it's not. And from that moment, you know, probably 2016 or 2008 on, everything is racist. Everything is racist. Like, and eventually you have white people using the word racist more than Black people. White people right. literally use the word more than I do. I don't even really use the word because I'm so careful. I understand the weight of the word. But now everything is racist. Like, you don't like something, like you don't like a particular song. Well, that's racist. Has nothing to do with race, right? I was thinking the same thing after October 7th, the word anti-Semitism. You're being anti-Semitic. It began to feel overused. And even if you asked a legitimate question, somehow you were too a Jew hater. Do you see that? Because I see the danger of that with everybody using the word racist. Because if everything's racist, then nothing's racist any longer. Right, and it's a powerful right. word that should stop people in their tracks. I'm feeling the same with the word anti-Semitic, that if everything's anti-Semitic, then it's going to lose its power to get people to pause and reconsider.
Yes, I think that you're putting your finger on something very important. And I don't know how to solve that issue, but I do think it's overused. And I do think that it's important, because people need to know that, you know, the greatest critics, for example, of Israel are Israelis, right? In other words, there's nothing wrong with being critical of Israeli policy. Nobody's saying that Israel's perfect, that the Jewish people are perfect. And therefore, if someone wants to point out, you look terrible. This George Soros is a Jew, and he's a bad person. Like, to me, that's not anti-Semitic.
Yes.
That's pointing out that George Soros, who happens to be a Jew and a very bad Jew, is horrible.
He's horrible.
And he's an embarrassment for my people. His soul somehow got corrupted. That's not anti-Semitic to put those two things together. And so we do have to be super careful and to be critical of Israel. The problem is fine to be critical of Israel and its policies. The problem is when it crosses the line. There's a certain line that crosses.
And what is that line?
The line is about double standards and demonization. And that's when it is. So in other words, when you say Israel's being terrible in the war in Gaza, with what we're doing for Palestinians, But you're ignoring the fact that the world is actually committing a war crime. They're violating human rights, Geneva Convention, by not letting the Palestinians out. Nobody talks about that. You mentioned it before, but the world had an obligation to take the Palestinians out of a war zone. Hamas started a war. Israel's defending itself. Take the Palestinians
Egypt
out.
Egypt wanted nothing to do with
that. That's
them.
Right. So when Iraq was in a war, they took them out, took civilians out. When Syria was in a civil war, they took millions out into Europe. And this is what humanity does, because that's part of the Geneva Convention. No Palestinian was allowed out. And then they could say, look, Israel should now supply humanitarian aid. Has any country ever supplied humanitarian aid in the middle of a war to their enemy? But all these things became expected. And it was that's all double standards.
Like when they were talking about a two-state solution, I was like,
right. So these are all double standards.
These people are literally saying from the river to the sea.
So when you're judging Israel and the Jewish people with double standards, or you're demonizing it and saying Israel's genocidal? How do you know the definition of genocide? That's like trying to wipe out a whole people. So the fact that 20,000 Palestinian civilians were killed in the war. And why is it that, how's that genocide? And why is it that everybody knows that there was 20,000 Palestinian civilians in the war? How many Syrian civilians were killed in that war? How many Iraqi civilians were killed in that war? How many in Russia and Ukrainian civilians? Nobody knows how many in anywhere else, but Palestinian conflict with Israel, everybody knows. That's a double standard. And that's a demonization when they call it genocide. That's when it crosses the line. And unfortunately, it's very, very prevalent to cross the line. And that I call Jew hatred. I don't call it anti-Semitism. So if you want to have a legitimate conversation and say, hey, why doesn't Israel do X or Y? Let's have that conversation that's not anti-Semitic.
Rabbi, thank you so much for being on with me.
It's a great pleasure. You're such a wonderful person. I look forward to talking more with you.
Absolutely. Maybe, you know, we have to find a way where we're sitting in front of a large audience and just, I think now is the time.
Well, you know, I made a film. Film on the same topic.
Tell us about it.
Let's do a screening. Okay, it's called Tragic Awakening. You can find it also on my website, RafaelShore.com with a PH. And it's called Tragic Awakening, and it's on the same inspiring topic, and maybe we can do a film screening together. But you can find out about how to screen it at the website and find out more about the book
I would love to partner with you on that. I think now is the time for Christians, especially for those, or even if you're not a Christian, but you're an American and you're a patriot and you just want to, and you see good. I think now is the time. If there was ever a time for us to stand up, what's happening in Israel and to the Jews is not just a Jewish problem. As you said earlier, Rabbi, it's universal. So thank you all for listening to the Kathy Barnett Show. Find me, hit me up on Insta or on Twitter, now known as X, at Kathy4Truth. Kathy for Truth. Listen to me everywhere. Share it. Thank you guys so much. Blessings and see y'all later.
Thanks for listening to Talk Radio 1210